You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Tongo Eisen-Martin. Tongo, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Tongo, I know we're going to talk about your poetry today, but I feel like, and you're going to read also, but just because today is April 13th, and we're in the middle of the pandemic in 2020. Where are you right now? Just to locate you before talking about exactly what you're working on now. Where are you now?
I'm in San Francisco.
What's the feeling there, if it's possible to address?
San Francisco adjusted to the quarantine pretty seamlessly. I guess one of the flip sides of gentrification is you have all this disposable income running around here that can afford to not go to work, as well as, you know, all these kind of like these startups and like tech, you know, big tech, smaller tech, that all can be worked at home. So it's not like, you know, the city didn't cry out for mobility. Everybody pretty much stayed indoors. It's not that dramatic out here. It's not that science fiction. People just kind of stick to the basics of it, and besides some inconveniences with the, you know, with stores being out of everything, it's pretty low key.
And what are you doing right now? What are you working on or consuming?
Oh, no, you know what? I should mention, though, that, you know, that's one side of it. But we are having a problem with our houseless people who are supposed to get housing in motels, but got kind of corralled into these concentration camp type of situations, and I don't know the ins and outs of the situation, but for the exact specifics, there was a big spread through some of these kind of makeshift shelters that people were kind of forced into. So that should be noted.
So you're talking about people without homes. You're talking about the homeless in San Francisco, which is situation is different there than it is in New York. New York, of course, has a similar situation, but you're saying they're not being cared for, really. That's not the. I mean, I understand also, like what you're saying at the beginning, San Francisco is the city of wealth, and at the same time, there's a homeless community there, and what's happening now? They're not being taken care of, or they are being herded into kind of a concentration camp-like shelter?
Not to be dramatic, but in essence, they got I want to say it was the Moscone Center or something. I'm blanking on the name of where, but they were forced to go into to shelter in a kind of a converted space, the space that got converted in. And just like COVID exploded in that space when they were originally supposed to get, I think it was like a deal with Motel 6. We're gonna open it up for them, and the city was gonna pay for it or something like that. Again, forgive me for not knowing the specifics, but it is right now. You have some, you know, protests going on.
That's part of the politics of what's happening locally in terms of managing the situation.
There's a groovy organization actually made up of doctors of doctors of color, forward thinking doctors who are really up in arms about this, and have been outside City Hall doing various actions and this type of thing. But that's also in the San Francisco landscape right now.
Right.
You know, and also I think, you know, we're concerned about the kids too. You know, the kids are supposed to get, you know, this kind of correspondence education, but I think, I don't know what the statistic is, like maybe 40% of the kids report not even that, like not being online, not having access to that, to the realities of education. Also, I think in California, period, are unstable. But
right.
You know, but again, painting the picture, I speak with an even tone because it's nowhere near like, you know, I'm just thinking of what happened in New York or what's happening in New York with all of the deaths and that, you know, just kind of that nightmare. We don't have anything. Yeah, we're not even in that kind of class of scenario.
Well, it's close. The situations are all the same in some sense. I just finished reading, you know, The Plague by Albert Camus, and he's talking about the same kind of feelings that we're all having here, and that was not that big a city. He's talking about it in the 40s in Algiers, and it's, I think, a compilation of different plagues or something, but we're all having the same kind of feelings. Everybody's inside, and you know, he said everybody, journalists are all becoming fortune tellers. Everybody's predicting the future in, you know, infinite variety of ways. And and that the government has either done too much or too little, too soon or too late, you know. It's a very similar kind of dialogue, strangely enough. But I think there are some similarities. And what are you working on right now? What's consuming you? Are you writing or...
So yeah, I'm working on poems, and I've been writing poems, writing essays, or kind of prose essay hybrids, and I've also been working on writing some curriculums, in light of the the murder of. What was the guy's name? Ahmaud Arbery.
Right.
And their sister who was killed in Louisville was named Breonna Taylor. Has been a resurgence of interest in extrajudicial killing of black people. And I wrote a curriculum back in 2013, I believe. To accompany a study called Operation Ghetto Storm, which was on extrajudicial killing. Now, you might be familiar with the every 28-hour statistic. That statistic was on sign at a certain point in the during of those protests in around Trayvon and Mike Brown. And that so the statistic that every 28 hours a police officer or security or even vigilante kills a black person every 28 hours. So I did a curriculum called But We Charge Genocide Again to kind of give the give the social context to these statistics. And so I'm actually going to start teaching it online. A group wanted me to teach for them. And so I'm putting you go back and you see what can be augmented and strengthened. So I'm kind of building out from the skeleton of that curriculum.
And so what will happen with that curriculum that you're making, that's for your students?
You know, it was made for it was made almost like a menu that any educator or could get their hands on and pet pull whatever they find useful, leave whatever is not. It could just be used. It could be used in classes. It can also just be used for if you just want to have a learning circle somewhere. It doesn't have to be within an institution. It's just basically just, political awareness, wherever people want to sit down and think about what makes society tick. And also, being talked with other people, too, again, people concerned with education that kids are really not getting at home. And so I've been the beginning stages of developing more curriculums on, that that folks can use at home, you know, especially they're not, you know, that I know some colleges are not, are for sure not going to open again until January. I'm not sure exactly where it is going to be for high school students and middle school students, but, you know, preparing people, preparing, you know, preparing curriculum so that if, you know, kind of this, if mass homeschooling, is a new norm, you know, putting some curriculums in people's hands that they can use at home.
Right. Let's hear one of your poems. I know you're going to read three today. What's the first poem that you're going to read? I'd love to hear it.
It's called "I Do Not Know the Spelling of Money." I go to the railroad tracks and follow them to the station of my enemies. A cobalt tooth man pitches pennies at my mugshot negative. All over the United States, there are toddlers in the rock. I see why everyone out here got in the big cosmic basket and why blood agreements mean a lot and why I get shot back at. Now, I understand the psycho-spiritual refusal to write white history or take the glass freeway. White skin tattooed on my right forearm, ricochet sewage near where I collapsed into a rat-infested manhood. My new existence is living graffiti. In the kitchen with a lot of gun cylinders to hack up, house of God in part, no cops in part, my body brings down the crisp. The new bullets pray over blankets made from old bullets, pray over the 28th hour's next beauty mark, extrajudicial Confederate statue restoration, the waistband before the next protest poster. Hey, by the way, time is not an illusion, Your Honor. I will save your death for last. You're witty, Your Honor. You're moving money again, Your Honor. It is only raining one thing. Non-white cops. And prison guard shadows reminding me of spoiled milk floating on an oil spill in the neighborhood, making a lot of fuss over its demise in New Lake for a Black Panther Party. Malcolm X's ballroom jacket slung over my son's shoulder, the figment of village, a new noose to a new white preacher, all in an abstract painting of a president. They bought slavery some time, didn't they? The tantrum screeches of military boats and election Tuesday car. A cold-blooded study in leg irons inside of a tornado shelter, leg irons inside of your body, proof that some white people have actually fondled nooses, that sundown couples made their vows of love over opaque plastic and bolt-action audiences, that Medgar Evers' second is definitely my favorite law of science, fondled noose clippings and primitive Methodists, my arm changes imperialisms, simple policing versus structural frenzy, elementary school script versus even wider white spectrum, Heartless leading in the challenge of watching civilians think the terrible rituals they have around the corner. They let their elders beg for public mercy. I'm going to go ahead and sharpen these kids' heads and the arrows myself. See how much gravy spills out of family crest. Modern fans of war, what with their t-shirt poems and t-shirt guilt and me having on the cheapest pair of shoes on the bus, I have no choice but to read the city walls for signs of my life.
Thank you for that reading. It's a very powerful poem. It also has a lot of music to it, it feels like to me, a kind of a rolling thunder feeling almost. Is that intentional or you know, the sound? I mean, it's a beautiful sound. It's a beautiful sound, but
the sure,
it feels very musical to me.
But there's a few, you know, the what I'm sure of is that that I got lucky in having a conversational style on the page so that when, you know, relating the poem, I can let it, you know, I can just kind of let it take care of itself. I can let the poem take care of itself as far as, you know, what kind of characters almost start taking over as I say the poem. But it's also, you know, if you can get down to almost like the micro, or I don't want to be grandiose and say quantum reality of a thought, there is something melodic down there, and in a lot of ways you can kind of you can get a faint sense that, you know, thoughts really do arise from kind of vibrations. And so the trick is to kind of just like not interfere so much with the energy, or don't mess up, don't interfere with the energy that's running through your kind of consciousness at the time for the sake of interfering with words. And it's a fragile kind of deal you can make with the cosmos. But, you know, we have this, you know, in a lot of ways, writing poems is just to tinker, to get your hands on thought and then tinker with it. And there's this little sweet spot in which you can tinker with words without tinkering with the energy beneath it. So I think if there is, you know, that some kind of musicality is made possible by not, you know, not being too, too harsh with your psyche, not kind of manhandling yourself too harshly. Like knowing how to play fight as opposed to fight yourself.
So let's hear another poem, or tell me, what's the next poem you want to read?
And the next poem is called The Chicago Prairie Fire. First, I must apologize to the souls of the house because I'm wearing the cheekbones of the mask only. Pill bottle, my name is yours, name tag on the side of a factory of wrist. I mean, teeth of the mask now. Back of the head of the mask now. A new phase of anti-anthropomorphism, intended for real faces. Stuck with one of those cultures that believes I chose this family. I'm not creative. Just the silliest of the revolutionaries. My blood drying on my only jacket. The police state psychic middlemen evangelizing for the creation of an unmastered and unmeasured. Blood of a land less racialized. An awesome prison sentence. Good guy. Elder abuse hired for the low. Dog eat genius while the right angle is made between a point on a Louisiana plantation and a five-year-old rubber ball 3 feet high and falling like a deportee plane to complete my interpretation of guard variety genocide. I'm small talk about loving your enemies a little more realistically, about paper tigers and also goals. You know, I need my left hand back. Broke my neck on a piano key, found paradise in a fist fight. You know, maybe I should check into the Cuban line. Watching the universe's last metronome, some call blackjack the Benze this way. These religions will start resigning in a decade or two, some colorfully, some transactionally in a cotton gothic society. Plaster trails on glasses. I mean, ironically, my window started fogging over too as I was trying to figure out which Haiti would get me through the winter, which poem houses souls, which socialist breakthroughs like taking 10 steps back and finally stillness. Stillness and stillness among families. I mean, a John Brown biography would take a bow. I'd be up next to introduce Prophet of the Month. I remember childhood. Remember the word childhood being a beginning. Scribbling on an amazing grace. I rented this body from some circumference of slavery. Remember being kicked out the Midwest. Strange food theater, lithium and circuses, like-minded stomachs. The ruling class blessing their blank checks with levy foam, with opioid teeth. $10 bills yelling to each other, pocket to pocket. Cello stands in the precinct for accompanying counter-revolutionaries. My mother raised me with a simple pain. A poet loses his mind. Like the room has weather. Or first girlfriend, gravity. The difference between me and you is the madness wants me forever. A pair of apartments defining both my family and political composure. Books behind my back, bail money paved into the streets, playing euphoria, cliche. Bracing for the medicines, recoil, sharing a dirty deli sandwich with my friends. Black Jacobins underground, topography or a grandmother's hand. I mean, psychology of the mask now. Teeth of the mask again. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very powerful poem, and of course is narrative here. You know, there's so much information and so much of a story in there, right? It's very visual, but also a tremendous amount of information of story, right? Some I can't even keep track of all of it, but it's it feels like there's such an urgency to tell that story too, and this is of course like a common thread in your work, right? Talking about situations of as I was talking before, of everything from, you know, mass incarceration to extrajudicial killings of black people you know, and things, and other things that are associated with so much of your work in education and poetry. So I don't know where to dive into this one. It feels like, wow, that's so much in there, and it kind of is so much about everything you do. Is there anything you want to say about that poem?
Well, specifically about the poem, what you say just kind of makes me think of, really what the opportunity of poetry is. I mean, there's dozens of opportunities to enjoy. But it's to really, to really let definition create the image. To really let political economy make the image, and not just kind of the musical freedom of language, but not for the sake of imagination. Although that definitely is part of the synthesis. But, basically this is kind of, just a political awareness run amok is really what the potential of poetry is. And therefore, in a way which you kind of, which you exposed, is that a lot of the poetry is a product of all the work I do before I get down to the page. And I don't mean that heroically, because if I don't put in this kind of work as far as political commitment, just commitment to studying reality, the poems and the poems are not possible. So I tell a lot of folks that, by the time you pick up a pen, it is kind of too late to accomplish, to accomplish things, to accomplish a kind of a thesis or, a plan, or, this is a life mission or this, that, and the third. Like, who you are is going to show up. What you've done is going to show up. It's going to be down there anyway. And so that, like a poem like the Chicago Prairie Fire, it's just chock full of that. It's just all, it's reality digested and survived. That then gets a chance to dance and synthesize with the musical opportunities, or really the mathematical opportunities of language, or the emotive math of language.
Let me ask you about one more poem. What is the next poem you're going to read?
The next poem I'm going to read is the Course of Meal. Apparently, too much of San Francisco was not there in the first place. And this dream requires more condemned Africans, to put another way, state violence rises down. Or still life is just getting warmed up. Or army life is looking for a new church and ignored all other suggestions. Or folktale writers have not made up their minds as to who is going to be their friends. Man, this is the worst downtown yet, and I borrowed a cigarette everywhere. I've taken many a walk to the back of a bus that led on out the back of a storyteller's prison sentence, then on out the back of slave scars, but this is my comeback face. I left my watch on the public bathroom sink and took the toilet with me. Threw it at the first bus I saw, eating single mothers half alive. It flew through the bus line numbered and on out the front of the White House, and hopefully you find comfort downtown, but if not, we brought you enough cigarette filters to make a decent winter coat. A special species of handshake, let's all know who's king. With a light standard uniform cloth, this coffin needs to quit acting like those are birds singing. Rusty nails have no wings, have no voice other than that of a white girl dying. Their book pages in the gas pump, catchy, isn't it? The way three nooses is the rule, or the way potato sack masks go so well with radio codes, or the way condemned Africans fought their way back to the ocean, only to find waves made in 1920s burnt up piano parts, European backdoor deals, and red flowers for widows who spent all day in the sun mumbling in San Francisco. Red flowers, but what's the color of the doctor visit? There are book titles in the streets. Book titles, like Hero, You Make a Better Zero, or Hey, Fur Coat Lady, The President is Dead, or Pay Me Back in Children, or They Hung Up Their Bodies in Their Own Museums, other book titles pulled from a drum solo. Run Here, Hero, Lie the Hiding Place. all the bullets in 10 precincts know where to go. There's no heaven or any other good idea in the sky. Politics means that people did it and people do it. Understand that when in San Francisco and other places, that was never really there. I bet this ocean thinks it's an ocean, but it's not. It's just 6th and Mission Street. I don't know who's king. King of that thing. You know, like America, I'm proud to deserve to die. I'm going to eat my dinner extra slow tonight in this police state candy dispenser. You all call the neighborhood. No set of manners goes unpunished. Never mind a murderer's insomnia or the tea kettle preparing everyone for police hours. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. That's a great one to read at the end here. I think in this one I should ask you, because the way you read, and I'm so glad you read today, because it's so exciting to hear you read, did you have any particular influence of the way you read it? You know, when I hear you, that what came to mind towards the end there was first record I heard by a poet when I was a teenager that really struck me, but it was The Last Poets. Mm. You know those guys?
Yeah, for sure.
So they're incredible, sure. Right? They it's maybe a different kind of poetry, but the way it was presented, the importance of the message, these words, this situation, And you know, if it doesn't relate, just tell me. Yeah, this is a reach, but it's something similar about your presentation, the musicality, as well as the, I don't want to say exactly the message, but something in there, something about the tone. You know, the way a poet reads. It's, I don't know how to say that, but you know, I know different poets are influenced by different people. Does that make sense? Is there someone in particular?
Where do I actually even, like, you know, I don't think there's any part of my style that you could even really call original. You know, who didn't I pull from? who am I not descended from? Definitely the last poets, almost, you know, it's kind of like the beginning of my living memory. My beginning of my sentient life, let alone the poetry that they've always been in my imagination. I spent a lot of time in the New Eureka Poets Cafe as a kid.
Right. That feels like that too, right? The poetry slams there. Yeah, it sounds like you'd be very comfortable there, right? How's that feeling too, of course? And,
yeah, they. Now, mind you, I never want to slam. I never want to slam. But you know that was really, you know, that was my, you know, that was my school. That was my, you know, that was grandma.
Yeah,
that makes sense, and that's funny
and interesting that you say you never want to slam, because it's also slams are about something else, right? You really are a decorated poet. You've won a lot of awards and all these things. You think you would, but a slam is yet something else, right? It's maybe 80% presentation, right?
Presentation is heavy. In a way, there is some, you know, there is a kind of an aspect of it that I could never really be a great competitor in. But I will say, there is this kind of sweet spot of a mind, or a sweet spot of the mind find that certain minds find themselves in, where there's this kind of upper echelon of poets who comes through the slam sphere, who commands, you know, who just really cannot be beat, at the same time has amazing poetry. I couldn't take anything from some of those legends, and probably those right now who are building their legend. While we can say that slam poetry is weighted more towards, you know, not just performance, but weighted towards kind of topic, you know, or
right.
weighted towards, you know, like definitely weighted towards playing to the mass choir.
Right. Well, to the audience, the kind of engaging the audience, getting them to go back and forth with you, almost like a live, like a very dynamic theater. You know, I mean, right?
Right.
Commenting. Whoa! Yeah. You know, like a active. I mean, that is a New York audience that also gets really active.
Right, if you can engage them. Right.
Well, I want to ask you one more question. What are you reading at the moment?
So right now, what I've been reading, I've been reading a few things, but the most exciting thing I've been reading is this biography of Jimi Hendrix by the poet David Henderson. David Henderson was one of the cats who founded that publication Umbra, which was a major landmark of the Black Arts Movement. And, you know, this cat, man, he was a genius. I mean, he has this book of poems called The Mayor of Harlem that's, you know, just brilliant. And he was like, and I think he was like 18 or 19 or something when he wrote it. So this is cat that's just been moving and grooving, you know, really, really, you know, just a beautiful poet, beautiful brother. And he wrote a biography of Jimi Hendrix that is just crazy. It's both like super hardcore, you know, kind of like music humanities, but then there's also this kind of almost Hendrix-esque storytelling itself that he kind of almost like adopted, you know, almost a Hendrix psyche in order to paint some of these pictures and paint some of these scenes. And also just some really trippy, like, you know, original, you know, analysis that it might not necessarily be, you know, the definitive take, but it's an interesting take. For example, that Jimi Hendrix was in the military and was a paratroopers.
Wow.
Is that the cat that jumped out the airplanes?
Yeah.
So Jimi Hendrix actually did some skydiving. So, you know, Henderson posits that, you know, that's some of the, you know, kind of some of the sounds that he was trying to make come from that experience. And some of the approaches to his guitar comes from that experience of just, you know, complete surrender to, you know, to a rush towards the ground. And then there's also all kind of other groovy, you know, musical history, because you can't tell the story of one musician without telling the story of a thousand along the way. So, but it's a really exciting. It's a really exciting book to read. It's one of those books that I try not to read at night because it'll keep me up.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time and your work, and thank you so much.
Appreciate you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.